It's 8:09. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Joining me now in the studio with a monthly update on open space, director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Let's start with the Bonanza Flat Survey. This is something the city's put out that you've posted on your website.
It's on the city's website, so parkcity.org, and we'll email it out and we'll put it out through our social media. And basically, it's asking people what they think should be done up there. How should we use it? How should we not use it? Those kinds of things. So it is, you know, parkcity.org, and it's right there on the front page when you go to the website. So we are encouraging people to go ahead and take a few minutes and take the survey.
All right. How much longer do people have to participate, do you know?
I don't know exactly when they're going to be done with that, but I wouldn't dally on that. You know, they have a pretty aggressive schedule for placing the permanent conservation easement on that property, and I know that Utah Open Lands, we are going up there and trying to figure out, you know, a survey, you know, what is on the property right now and where are there places that are perhaps more critical to be protected than others. So, go ahead and if people are interested, go ahead and give their opinion sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Interesting. I had a caller tell me about she was driving by the area coming back from the Brighton area there on 224 and said that there was an open campfire happening up there. Called 911. Apparently it was in Wasatch County, but basically they told her that it's open fires are allowed in Wasatch County. Is that something that we would see in the future then?
You know, again, these are the questions that people are trying to address, and people have been camping up there. I've been up there hiking several times and see people, you know, hiking in, hiking out with their sleeping bags and their roasting forks. But it is a use that has happened for years and years up there. Whether or not that's a great idea and whether or not and how that might or might not continue is something that the city is really trying to figure out right now.
All right. A heads up that Park City and the fire crews will be doing some clearing in Round Valley. What's happening there?
That's right. So this is an effort to make sure that should something happen out there in Round Valley, that it doesn't spread to the adjacent neighborhoods. So we just wanted people to know if you're out in Round Valley and you see some people out there clearing brush and things like that, it's not for development coming down the pike. It's just safety.
Okay. Anywhere in particular that's happening or just really
along Round Valley Way and around down to Valder Road, I think.
All right. You're also helping the city with biocontrols for spotted knapweed.
Spotted knapweed, yes. So there's an insect apparently that will, and spotted knapweed is an invasive that can cause a lot of trouble, and there's an insect that will eat it. So our land protection specialist has been out there working with the city to introduce this and will monitor the success or not of whether or not that works.
So the spotted knapweed is the invasive species,
right.
And so you're putting bugs out there in hopes that
they will eat that.
What does that stuff look like?
Actually, I'm always worried about these kinds of things because, you know, the mongoose situation in other parts of the world where you introduce one control to save another one. But this one, you know, we have learned from that experience, and this one apparently is safe and does work. So anyway, you know, the gist of it is that we are really trying to keep our open spaces as healthy and weed-free and in a natural state as possible, which isn't easy, you know, when people and dogs and everything and we're there and those types of things, those uses do tend to spread those invasive weeds. And if they get out of control in a place like Round Valley, it's really hard to control it. You know, the city pays people to go out and hand pull a lot of the weeds out there because they don't want to spray a bunch of hideous chemicals. So this is a way of controlling these invasive species, which is an obligation when you have land, without a lot of nasty chemicals that might, you know, again, affect our water supply and things like that.
I'm just pulling it up. It's actually a pretty flower.
A lot of times they are. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. You've also, you being the Summit Land Conservancy, have applied to hold a preservation easement on the library field. So this was done through an RFP process?
An RFP process. That's right. So the city went through quite a lengthy discussion with COSAC and, you know, the Citizens Open Space Advisory Committee and the Recreation Advisory Committee to decide whether or not they really should put a preservation easement on the library field. And all of the groups had a lot of discussion and said, yes, we should, and here's what we should protect. And basically the idea is that it will be a field forever. But then the question is, you know, the devil's always in those details. How do you decide? Should we put up a tent for Sundance? Should we put up bouncy houses for the 4th of July? Anyway, after a whole lot of discussions, many of those questions have been answered. And so the city said, okay, yes, we'll put a preservation easement on it. And they put out a request, basically, for people who might want to hold the conservation easement. And the Summit Land Conservancy, you know, this is not even a mile, half a mile, quarter mile, 100 yards from our offices. So I think the interesting thing about this is a lot of times we think of conservation easements and the kind of work that, you know, an organization like a land trust, the Summit Land Conservancy, does is the big things, Round Valley or Bonanza Flat or, you know, landscape scale things. In fact, across the country, more and more land trusts are finding that it's these little, what we might have called pocket parks. It's the local community green space where you can go out and lay in the grass. You can look at the clouds. You can chase your dog. You can, you know, discover spotted knapweed, maybe. And these are critical to human health and well-being. And so it really is important that we preserve some of these places and don't cover every square inch with concrete and bricks.
Okay. So if you get it, then what does that mean?
That means that we then work with the city and draft the conservation easement and a baseline. And by the end of December, or maybe the beginning of December, that place is permanently protected as a field.
Okay. And then just finally, a plug for the Junior Explorer Camp and the Blue Sky Bash.
That's right. So we have two more weeks of camp. 1 week is sold out. The second week has one spot available, and that is July 14th, the week of July 14th. And that's our Junior Explorers Camp. So it's 5- and 6-year-olds. It's a half-day camp from 9 to noon 30, 12:30. And we have one spot available left on that one. So, and it's $200, and we take kids out. We do all kinds of fun things. And then the Blue Sky Bash, which is our major gala fundraiser and a very festive party. It's hosted out at the Blue Sky Ranch in Wanship. It's catered by High West. We have wonderful sponsors. We have a signature cocktail, and there are less than 10 tickets left. So go to wesaveland.org and saddle up.
Okay.
Get your boots.
So a little bit more research here. The knapwood root weevil. The insect can safely be considered the king of spotted knapweed biocontrol. It's a large, conspicuous insect laying its eggs on the top of the knapweed's root crown. After the eggs hatch, the larvae burrow into the root. Oh, my gosh. It looks pretty successful,
Did we want to know that?
Yeah.
How the biocontrol works. It isn't all that pretty.
Recent research by Montana State University has documented up to a 99% reduction in knapweed density as a result of the weevil introduction.
And our land protection specialist actually was part of some of the initial research on this. So she's real up on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Cheryl. See you next month.
Thank you.
8:18 now. Good morning. The Summit County Council meeting tomorrow at the Rich and Services Building. Work session starting at 3:50 in the studio with the previous Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
At 3:55, a dedication of a photo. This is going to be a memorial to former Summit County Attorney Robert Hilder. This is what, going to hang where?
It will hang in the courthouse in Colville, somewhere near the attorney's office. We haven't picked out the exact spot yet, but the council wanted to present this to the family today, and staff has been working on it for the last few weeks to make sure we get it ready for that.
Okay. Then a discussion of park and ride intercept lots. That the staff report says an advisory committee looked at three spots, so let's run through some of those.
Well, it actually looked at several spots in the county, but this is kind of some of the conclusions that they came to was that something out at the Kimball Junction area, in order to perhaps take advantage of the transit center that's there in the future. However, the problem is that the zoning there doesn't currently allow us to do something like that. Plus, we don't own any more property in order to do it. So it might be a little bit longer term for us to be looking at that, but certainly being looked at as the Kimball Junction neighborhood planning is going on. Some type of parking out, remote parking or intercept parking at around the Jeremy Ranch interchange, you know, taking advantage of that interchange and its connection with I-80 and being west of Kimball Junction itself. And then out on the other side of the area to get into Park City, where Quinn's Junction and 248 meet.
All right. So let's talk about the Ecker View site.
Sure.
This is where we've talked about putting a 550-lot parking spot lot. The report said one disadvantage, of course, is that it's near the Ecker Hill Middle School and perhaps a future school.
Absolutely. I mean, the school district has been looking at that school for expansion. A disadvantage, but you know, it's pretty hard to find a spot where we don't have disadvantages. There are some things that we could do to mitigate some of those disadvantages. If there's increased traffic there, we can improve intersections. We can improve the way that the school is accessed. As well, there's certainly several weekends or days during the year where people are parked up on Kilby Road because the overflow from events from some of the things that happen at the school. We can put a pedestrian access to this lot underneath the road in order to make it easier to get back and forth and maybe relieve some of that pressure on Kilby Road itself. So even though there are disadvantages, there are also ways that we can mitigate some of those things.
Well, why not just keep it as an off-ramp from the freeway?
Well, that was our original plan. However, the federal government who owns the highway doesn't like to do that. When they don't like to have intercept lots because they have these other places in the country. They prefer to have those accessed off of local roads and not off of their highway. So they're sticking with that policy as we move forward, they don't want to set a precedent with us. There sometimes are other ways to deal with that. So we're not sure what the final design is going to be yet.
All right, and the Richardson Flat was also mentioned. The staff report says, and this was news to me, it was meant to be more of a construction mitigation parking lot?
Well, originally, it was built by the Talisker Group in order to mitigate some of the construction that they were doing. It was supposed to hold construction vehicles, and then they were supposed to be bused up to their sites at some of the resorts. But, not sure it was ever used in that manner to its total benefit. However, now that we have a transit route out going out to Camas, that's still a test program per se. We're seeing how that works, and it's working well. But we have the ability as we make improvements to 248 and the city and UDOT do that to make that lot more viable for a park and ride.
And then a third location was the Boyer Tech Park. The staff report, though, says this is not included in the Boyer Master Plan. I'm guessing if it was in the park, where would it be?
Well, going back to what I was talking about with the Kimball Junction Neighborhood Master Plan or neighborhood planning that's going on, the open land that's available is currently in the Boyer Tech Park. So there might be a logical place. There is a parcel between the visitor center and the transit center right now that is not built on. That could be a logical place for a park and ride. But we kind of have to wait for that planning to run its course.
Yeah. There was also a few sites discussed along Highway 40, but we can't use the triangle parcel because that's now open space.
It is. There are other possibilities along the 40 corridor. It makes a little bit more sense to concentrate some of that activity around the interchanges where it can be easily accessed, not only by the vehicles accessing intercept lots, but also by transit, which we're hoping to get people on transit.
So you're thinking that doesn't make a lot of sense to come off and then have to travel along the frontage road and then get back on.
Yeah, it makes less sense. If we have a possibility to find some property around the interchange itself and capture some vehicles before they get into our most congested areas, then could be a higher value.
Yeah, but that's still the same argument then for having the Acker Hill lot, no?
Well, the Acker Hill lot also is available. UDOT is willing to work with us on that property, and there is not a lot of open property available out in that area. Similar argument to why the county council chose to purchase the Klein Dolly parcel next to the Jeremy Ranch School is that it's one of the last remaining parcels out there that we can work with in order to make some of these transportation solutions.
And that was certainly another possibility.
It was.
The Klein Dolly parcel. All right. So what direction are you looking for the council tomorrow?
Just really, we have, even though that Doug Clyde and Glenn Wright have been on the council now for 7 months, they haven't heard a lot about these projects because we've been concentrating and getting the stuff out the door and implemented that you've seen over the last 2 months with our transit system and with e-bikes. You know, these projects are starting to get lined up for the next few years, and infrastructure construction projects take a little longer. So we want to bring these in front of them in the context of the overall list of projects that we're implementing to try and improve traffic, reduce traffic congestion.
Yeah. Now the out at the transit center, Kimball Junction Transit mm-hmm. Center. I mean, are those 45 spots completed yet? Parking spots?
They are not yet. You know, that was going to be a further phase, I believe we're going to try and do some work on that this year. We were trying to work it into our road and bridge schedule as they had time. They've been very busy this summer doing some resurfacing projects. So,
yeah. Any complaints from the Walmart Center businesses there because people are using that private parking?
I have not heard any formal complaints, but anecdotally, I saw a security guard standing at the corner of that parking lot this morning. Don't know if that's related to it, but it was at 7 a.m. When I drove by, it could be related to folks parking there. You know, as I drive through that intersection quite a bit in my day, I don't see a lot of vehicles parked over there, but that doesn't mean that it's not happening.
I've heard the same thing, that it is happening, so just curious, but you haven't heard anything. Let's see. Another business, the council will be ratifying the tax rate for Weber Basin Water District. Any idea when you give the auditor an answer on the county's property tax rate?
Well, you know, we have to, the council, as part of our budget process and a formal truth and taxation process, need to be in that process by October. And the first step of that is actually declaring what your proposal is for tax rates. We expect the council to do that. I also expect to be in front of the council one more time, at least one more time, either by the end of August or the beginning of September, to talk to them publicly about that.
I noticed the tax notices came out, but I didn't have a chance to analyze mine. I'm just curious how. I mean, is there a proposed tax increase in, you know, how they schedule? It's like current taxes and then proposed taxes?
So in the options that we've put in front of the council, we've looked at a range of options. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those have tax rates associated with them. I don't know what those are off the top of my head.
Okay. But has that been publicized, though, as part of this tax notice?
It has not, because that tax notice is for the current tax year.
Got it. All right, let's see. The interlocal agreement for the Central Wasatch Commission, formerly known as Mountain Accord. The council just voted on this in June, didn't it?
They voted on the agreement to participate and continue their financial participation within the Central Wasatch Commission. So now there contemplates a Wasatch-backed representative. It was both councils' desire to formalize that process so that we have a way forward on how we're going to propose that person to the Central Wasatch Commission. This agreement formalizes that and basically says that in the first 2 year period, Park City Council will nominate somebody, and the county council will react to that. In the second 2 years, the county council will nominate that person, and then the Park City Council ratify that. So that ILA is on the agenda this week, as well as Park City's nomination of Councilman Bierman.
Okay. And is that going to be the Summit County Council's nomination as well?
I believe that's the way they're leaning at this point.
Okay. And then given the lawsuit over the Mountain Accord in Salt Lake City, does the Central Wasatch Commission now have to hold open meetings?
I believe so. And I believe they have been following the Open Meetings Act as they've met once so far.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I don't have anything else, Leslie.
All right, Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. There are three candidates running for Park City Mayor. They're Roger Armstrong, Andy Bierman, and Dana Williams. KPCW is beginning a series of candidate interviews with all three of them. We're starting this morning with Roger Armstrong. We'll be talking with Andy Bierman tomorrow and Dana Williams on Thursday. And then on Friday morning, We're going to have a two-hour candidate forum right here at KPCW. So welcome to Roger Armstrong.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what do you want people to know about you? You know, let me tell you what I know about you. You live in Aspen Springs. You have worked as an attorney in the entertainment business. You have served on the county council for one term and almost 1 year, just reelected in November unopposed. Anything else you want people to know about you?
Nope, I think that's it. I can go now. Thank you.
Well, one reason someone may vote against you is perhaps a flattering one, and that's that they want to keep you on county council. So why run for mayor now again when you just won an election and ran unopposed and not even a year into your second term?
Great question. I think the answer is, number one, I live here. This is my backyard. This place is special to me. It's important to me. It's one of the great, if not the greatest economic driver in the county. It's way up there. I don't know where it relates to Snyderville at this point. The Snyderville Basin is growing rapidly, but it's still the primary economic driver. And I'm looking to protect this place. I think it's beautiful. We all came here for similar reasons involving the environment that we're in, the recreation opportunities, just the general collegial nature of the community. That all becomes placed at some risk or peril by growth factors that have come into play since the Olympics. And those trigger issues like traffic and how many events do we have and do we have enough housing? They're all outgrowths of growth. I was pressed very hard by people in the community starting a year ago to consider running, and I resisted it. I love my job at the county, and I think we've done terrific work, and I love my colleagues at the county even more than just doing the work. They're very smart. They're very strategic. The staff is terrific. We've worked very hard in the last 5 years to make sure that we provide outstanding service to residents. So that was a very hard decision. As we got closer to the election and as it became apparent who was going to file to run, the requests and demands and pushing to run got more pronounced, and I started to look at the skill sets that were there, and I thought that with my background, the approach that I have to solving problems, I just bring something very, very different than the other two candidates. And I think if you look at each of us in isolation in terms of our skill sets, our backgrounds, our experience, there are three choices, and they're very people may choose for very different reasons, but in terms of being able to confront the very, very sophisticated problems that we have facing us and the players that are coming into the community that have very, very sophisticated representatives to get what they need, I think you need somebody with higher level skills.
Yeah, but certainly that I can understand that if you're making the decisions on county council or city council, the mayor is just a figurehead position. I mean, you're not in the trenches there, you know, setting policy.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I mean, there is, you know, if you look on paper, the mayor is it's what they would call a weak mayor position, presiding over ceremonials, speaking for the city, awarding resolution. I don't know what all the mayor does, those kinds of ceremonial services, performing weddings. But the mayor is the sixth council member. He's not a voting member, but he is the sixth council member, and the mayor runs the meetings. So part of the issue that I have with the city council, and I think, you know, some members of the city council take issue with it, is some of the issues that they've identified are easy issues to identify. You know, it's easy to say we want to build 800 units of affordable housing. Affordable housing is a nice trigger. It's a great aspirational goal. But as soon as you start having that conversation, somebody better start asking questions about where, for whom, what kinds of restrictions can we put on it? How does the funding apply to the restrictions that we can put on it? Are we prepared to add 2,000 at least? That's just on a regular, how many bodies typically occupy a unit in any kind of housing. In our area, we've seen with the Colby School and other places, there are a lot more bodies in some of these housing facilities than that standard norm. So are we prepared, just under the straight calculation, to increase our population by 25%? Because adding 2,000 to 7,900 or 7,800 is a major increase. The cars that come with that, how are we going to deal with it? Andy said that there are detailed plans for it. I searched everywhere I could on that city website for that detailed plan about what they're going to do with affordable housing. I found studies. I found a 2016 analysis. But I've not seen that kind of plan. Have we looked at the land management code to see how that relates? So that's what the mayor can do. The mayor runs the meetings. The mayor can tease those questions out and make sure that proper consideration is given by staff and by the council in making those decisions. And more importantly, the mayor, by identifying those issues, calling them out, and being a spokesperson and an advocate in one way or another about those issues, engages the citizens and the residents more and allows their voices to be heard, and that's critical.
How long have you lived within the city limits of Park City? Because you lived in Promontory for a while, right?
Never lived in Promontory. No? We've been in Park City for 12 years. Same house since we moved here.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about policy issues that you think you differ on with the other two candidates. All three of you are pretty liberal guys.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The policy issues, like I said, I think it's, again, it's aspirational versus practical. I don't think any of us would argue that traffic is a problem. And I would argue that traffic may be the primary problem, that if we make transportation extremely efficient, extremely easy, we may actually take some of the burden off of the need for affordable housing. The county has approximately 1,000 units that will come online by 2021 between the Canyons, Silver Creek Village, the Discovery property, Whole Foods, the Richer Apartments came on a year ago. We've got affordable housing coming online. If we can connect that up with an easy route in for employees, I mean, the Canyons parking has employees on site with a grocery store. So it's very sticky. So I think I think the issues are probably consistent. Dana thinks that we should make for more free parking in the core. I'm concerned about what that does to traffic. So we probably differ there about our analysis in terms of how to implement and what's important. But I think it's doing the real problem solving. I think it's what I do in my professional life and on the county council is to try and identify the problem with some degree of specificity. And I think once you do that, once you break this overall, we've got a transportation problem, down to a core set of problems, you can really start to address those. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's how many cars can we take off the road? Well, we've put in place a sequential number of solutions that are designed to take a certain number of cars off the road. Affordable housing, you've got to tease out all of those issues. Where are you going to put it? How is it zoned? How are we going to pay for it? Does the way we're going to pay for it make sense? Who's going to operate it at the end of the day? Is the city going to own it and be in the housing business for decades? Is somebody else going to do it? They're much, much bigger issues, and I personally haven't heard that discussion.
How do you feel about that? I mean, should the city be in the real estate and development business?
I'm not sure that they should. You know, we've had great luck on the county side having developers take that over. I mean, the Canyons has a housing obligation. The Silver Creek Village developers put in the obligation to build 330. We required that be built first before each other stage goes forward. The Whole Foods had to build their employee housing obligation first. The Canyons we got to a little bit late, but our discussions with them are proving they're working out really well, we hope, if we can bring it across the finish line to get that housing built much earlier than they're obligated to do it. It's understanding the relation between housing and the businesses. So the city sees the need for it. Vail understands the need for it. They need to have their employees housed. How do we make it so that we get some of the developers to take over that obligation rather than the city having to spend money doing it? And those are the challenges. And again, it goes back to the fundamental issue of how much do we need and where do we have to locate it? This is a city that's in the redevelopment phase of its life rather than the outward growth phase. There's not a lot of land remaining, so now we've got to figure out what's going to come down or get converted to housing. And it's a challenge, I think, to do it on an ad hoc basis where this condo development just came online and we might be able to pick this up for a price. And we start aggregating millions of dollars with not a lot to show for it.
One other difference, I think, that's been brought up between you and Councilmember Andy Bierman, of course, is the Mountain Accord, now the Central Wasatch Commission. That's going to be on your agenda as a county council person tomorrow to nominate him as the Wasatch Back representative. But you still don't support where we're going with this.
Let's say that I have a healthy degree of suspicion about the Mountain Accord. You know, historically, Sandy City has been looking for a way to provide transportation up into the Cottonwoods and for a link to Park City. That requires a lot of federal money to do. The feds told Sandy City years ago, if you're going to make something like that work, you're going to have to get approval of all the jurisdictions impacted. The Mountain Accord grew up not too long after that and has been proceeding. And initially, the Mountain Accord was characterized as being focused on four issues involving recreation, economics, environment, and transportation, the Central Wasatch. That changed when they finalized the plan. It's now a transportation plan with an eye toward, as you implement transportation, how does it impact the economics, the recreation, and the environment. But it's primarily a transportation plan now. Its four founding members are Sandy City, Cottonwood Heights, Salt Lake City, and Salt Lake County. The Wasatch Back has a representative that's invited to participate and can be removed at any time by the four original founders and UDOT. It's now being chaired by Tom Dolan, who happens to be the mayor of Sandy City. So I think it's up to us to have a healthy degree of skepticism as to what the overall goal is and whether it's ultimately in Park City and the basin's best interest.
Well, you've been voting against it. Are you going to vote again against tomorrow on the vote?
I don't know. I think we need to have a discussion. Part of my concern was that if our representative is, our being Summit County's representative, is from Park City, we don't really have a representative because we can't control how Park City operates, the decisions that they make. And I do have deep concerns about that, but we've since had conversations with Park City. We're trying to put a formal process in place that would effectively give Summit County a voice vis-a-vis how that Wasatch Back representative is authorized to work, and I think that gives me some degree of comfort.
Well, just another 30 seconds. Why should people vote for Roger Armstrong?
I've got the experience to actually guide the city in a direction that will directly address the issues that we face, that will engage our citizens on a more active basis, that will allow their voices to be heard and considered in the process. And I think at the end of the day that the skill sets that I bring are exactly what we need to address the issues that we face.
Okay. Roger Armstrong, we'll see you on Friday.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:45. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, yesterday, Mountain Hub, a Park City company, released its next generation of its mobile and desktop app. And the studio to tell us what Mountain Hub is and how that new app works is the company's co-founder and CEO, Brent Markle. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So what is Mountain Hub?
So Mountain Hub is a community-fueled app for the outdoors. And we help people find great information in the outdoors from adventurers like them. So anything from trail conditions, real-time climbing conditions, river conditions, routes, et cetera, and all overlaid on some really great maps that we have that work all around the world. And so we've been in Park City now for the last couple of years, and we're really excited about this update.
So you've been in Park City. Did you move from somewhere else?
We did. We moved from Boston about 3 years ago and packed our bags. And we can get into kind of the story, you know, where we started. But we moved about 3 years ago, packed everything up. And 3 years later, here we are.
Yeah. So why Park City?
So Park City, first of all, you know, if you're starting a company in the outdoors, there's no better authentic place to be. And all of us are passionate about hiking, mountain biking, skiing, and we just felt that this would be a great place to launch our brand and build our community.
Yeah. So tell me about the app. It's an update, so it's been out on the market for a while?
Yeah. So we launched our first update in November, or our first app in November. So it's been, you know, around only for a little bit. This is the first time we're actually really actively promoting Mountain Hub. So we're doing this launch with Black Diamond, down in Salt Lake. They're helping us promote the app at a global level. And, you know, I think the best comparison for Mountain Hub is like Waze for the outdoors. I don't know if you've ever used Waze to crowdsource, you know, traffic conditions and where the traffic is, where the cops are, where, you know, if there's cars parked on the shoulder. In the same way that people crowdsource traffic conditions, Mountain Hub helps people get the best access to real-time information in the outdoors.
Yeah. So when we talk about Mountain Hub, it's you and another co-founder, and there are others as well? I mean,
yes, exactly.
Yeah. How many people in the company?
So we're 9 now, Jim Christian is my co-founder. We met actually in a product design class at MIT when we were in grad school. So Jim's on the engineering side, and I'm on the business side. And the two of us initially met. Some of those listening in today may have heard of Avatech. Avatech was the initial company that we started about 3 years ago, and it was focused on crowdsourcing winter safety information for elite mountain guides and ski areas like Park City and Deer Valley and Alta Snowbird, et cetera. And really over, 3 years, we built up this network all around the world in about 30 different countries, crowdsourcing information in the winter months. And soon people started asking us, well, hey, if we can crowdsource avalanche conditions, snow conditions, weather information in the winter, why aren't you guys doing this in, for all activities year round? It's as if, Waze was only letting truck drivers share information. We realized, wait, we should enable this for anyone.
Yeah. But how can one app sustain so many, 9 people?
So that's one of the, I think, beautiful things of being a software company. With the App Store and Google Play Store, our storefront is the world. And so we have users that can download us. We're in about 7 different languages. So we have users in Europe, in New Zealand, and Chile, really all over the world. Now, we're focused mainly on the U.S. That's our and mountain towns in the U.S. And so when we think of kind of our core focus, Park City is kind of the ultimate playground for our app.
Yeah. So since it's a free app, I explain to me how you guys even make money to support 9 people on
yeah.
the payroll.
So, kind of a good analogy for how Mountain Hub, our business model, I actually got engaged about a couple months ago and started using a website called theknot.com to plan out the wedding. And as you're going through the planning process, when you have to send your invites, for example, it says, hey, looks like you need to send some invites out for your wedding. Here are our partners at invite.com or whatever it is, and here's a 20% discount. And they ultimately do a revenue share. The Knot does a revenue share with the different partners that it has as you're planning your wedding. So in the same way, the way Mountain Hub monetizes is we work with different brand partners, Black Diamond or other partners, to put whether it's gear or travel opportunities or experiences in front of our audience at times when it's really valuable and at times when it matters. So if you're actually planning a ski trip, for example, to Chamonix, we can say, hey, by the way, it looks like you're planning a great ski trip to Chamonix. If you need any gear, here's a couple recommendations that we have for you. So we don't, we're not advertising, we're not putting, toothpaste in front of our audience. We're putting really value-added information that can actually help them when they're planning a trip, for example.
So the partnership with Black Diamond then will work. It'll coordinate between both their website and your app then? Is that how it works?
Yes. So they have a place on their website mm-hmm. where they have some information about Mountain Hub. Primarily the support they've been giving us has been through social media, so through Facebook and Twitter. Yesterday they did a big announcement out to their following on Facebook to several 100,000 people. And it's just really great to have such a wonderful brand like Black Diamond behind what we're doing. And, we're all big fans of Black Diamond and we use a lot of their products. And I think that they have just a great diverse community across many of the activities that we're serving. So it's a very natural fit.
Yeah. So if I were to open the app, and what would I see, like, with Jenny's being closed, that trail up
sure.
on the mountain?
Yeah.
Would that put a little incident,
Yeah. So you would open it up to really any area on the map, and you would see the real-time user-generated content, UGC, or reports in that area. So you might see trail condition updates. You might see that closure. You might see someone actually track their route up that trail and then took photos along the way. One of the really powerful parts of this, one of the new features that we're launching, it's called adventure tracking, is there's a lot of apps out there that are really competitive. And, you can see how you stack up against, your friends, or you can see how you stack up against other people in the community. And one of our beliefs at Mountain Hub is that we want to enjoy the outdoors and we want to help each other. We want to share valuable information. And, you know, hiking up Jenny's, for example, it's not a race. And so the way that we've designed the platform is that when you're, you know, tracking a route, for example, sure, we'll give you all of those stats. But we're really also helping you share that experience in an authentic way. And as you take your photos, for example, they're automatically geotagged and overlaid on the map. So you can see exactly where that closure is, or you can see exactly where, you know, the turnoff point is, or, you know, in the backcountry skiing community, where the entrance to the couloir is, for example. So we've really designed the technology to reinforce those values of our company.
Cool. So people can just search Mountain Hub and they'll find it?
Yeah, you can search us on the App Store. Just look up Mountain Hub, and it's a free app. Again, great maps, great information, and for any outdoor activity, it's totally free.
Cool. Anything else you want to tell our listeners?
We're just thrilled to be here in Park City and, you know, homegrown company. You know, we'd love to be a success story for the city, and really appreciate the support as well. We won an economic development grant from the city as well. And so Park City's been behind us from the get-go, and we're immensely appreciative to the whole community for supporting us.
Great. Well, good luck, and thanks for your time this morning, Brent.
Great. Thanks, Leslie.
It's Brent Mark. It's 8:54 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, millions of dollars in funds and properties awaiting claim for the rightful owners or descendants. Some of that belongs to Summit and Wasatch County residents. In the studio to explain, I have Utah State Treasurer David Damchin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be with you.
So last year, the amount was some $375 million. What are we talking about in terms of the overall total of unclaimed money and property?
You know, we work really hard to reunite properties with the rightful owners. We're paying out about $23 to $24 million a year. However, each year we take in another $30 to $40 million. So as hard as we try to keep up, that $375 million keeps growing slowly. And we're still at about that number in terms of the total properties outstanding.
Okay. So of that, can you tell us how much is coming from Summit County and Wasatch County?
Yeah, we have $6.9 million in Summit County and $1.3 million in Wasatch County. And the reason I'm here today is to meet with some local leaders to sit down with some lists of some of the largest properties and owners to see if some names can be recognized and if we can sort of grease the wheels and get more money back to rightful owners here in Park City and in Wasatch County, Summit County, both. I started this process last summer, went to Tooele and Richfield and Logan and sat down with local leaders, and it's amazing in small communities. Needless to say, you sit down with a list, someone who's been in the community for many years and knows folks, it doesn't take long before they start recognizing names and they make a phone call. 1 in 5 Utahns have a property that we're holding for them. So I guarantee you, if anyone sits down for 20 or 30 minutes, goes to mycash.utah.gov and plugs in a last name of a friend or a family member or coworker, take 20 or 30 minutes, you'll find someone you know. We're holding property for them, and all they need to do is go to mycash.utah.gov to initiate a claim.
All right, so where did this money and property come from?
It comes from so many different places. It might be an uncashed rebate check. It might be a bank account that was forgotten and the owner moved and the bank couldn't find them. And eventually, under the law, businesses that hold these properties have to pass that property to the state so that we can work to get it back to the rightful owner.
Yeah, I think I read the average amount of a refund is like $400 or something.
That's right. It can be larger. We actually had someone lose track of a $400,000 account once, and we were very happy to track that person down. This is exciting. It's kind of like Santa Claus, 365 days a year, except that this is people's own money. It's kind of like when you pick up that pair of Levi's off the floor and there's a $20 bill you forgot about, except hopefully the dollar amount's a little bit larger here. But yeah, it's your own money, and it's one of the most rewarding parts of being state treasurer is helping people be reunited with their own money.
Right. So is there a statute of limitations then to reclaim it?
There's not. So we've been tracking this information. That $375 million, that started accruing in the 1950s. And so if your grandmother or great-grandfather passed away in 1962 and had lost properties, you go search under those names and find that you know, that's there and you're in error, those properties can be claimed. So we hold on to it forever until someone related to the original owner comes to claim the property.
Hmm. You can't just, I don't know, distribute it to maybe the education system?
Well, that's a good point. I mentioned how we take in about $40 million and pay out about $20 million. So there's a mechanism in place whereby we pass a residual amount that is, frankly, will not ever be reunited to the rightful owners. Every year, that's about $15 or $20 million. That goes to the Uniform School Fund. That's the whole point of unclean properties. If we can't get it back to the rightful owner, then the benefit should inure to the public in general, and the public school system is seen as the best mechanism through which to do that. So that's where some of the money goes anyway when we're unsuccessful in getting every single dollar reunited to rightful owners.
Yeah, so some of this, it sits in some kind of escrow account? I mean, is it collecting interest?
It's collecting interest. The interest proceeds end up going to the Uniform School Fund. When we hold a property, if you lost $400, this is a catch, right? If you lost $400 today and your heirs claimed it 150 years from now, inflation's going to be pretty rough on that $400, and it won't be worth nearly as much then as it is now. So that's the one caveat. That's why we encourage people to go to mycash.utah.gov, check it out, search for friends, family members, coworkers. We want to get that money back to the rightful owner. I know that's not what people are used to hearing from government, but seriously, we don't want this money in the state's coffers. We want it back in your pocket.
All right. So you mentioned you traveled to several counties last summer. You're doing it again this summer of mm-hmm. the 29 counties. Have you been to them all yet? Or
haven't been to all of them. We've been selecting larger, denser rural communities where we can maximize impact, and we're just kind of chipping away as we go. And excited to be here in Park City this morning.
Okay. Anything else you want to let people know?
No, I want to encourage them to go to mycash.utah.gov and do a search. Yourself, family members, friends, coworkers, neighbors, I guarantee someone you know has property there. And I really appreciate your help getting the word out, Leslie. This is the key. We're ringing the dinner bell and telling people we've got this money for you.
Okay. David, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.